This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
So, Jonathan, we wanted to start by asking you about a volume that you edited several years ago, Against Health, and to unpack that idea of against health and what it means to take up a critical stance towards certain rhetorics of health. You know, the question is motivated by the fact that all of us, Aaron included, work in communities of health professionals where we think of ourselves as for health, of course, and really devoted as a kind of sacred mission to advancing health for people. And I think in that context, this kind of critical gaze on the concept of health or certain uses of health is both very much needed and also painful sometimes. And so can you talk a little bit about that idea of a stance of being against health?
Sure. Well, first let me say a couple things. And just to repeat for the people in the back, there are seats up in the front here for there are people that are wandering out there. But let me just say how honored I am to be here, first of all, before I get to that question, if you don't mind. Like, this is just really freaking awesome. What a great crowd. And I'm so honored to be here and have this conversation. And I've had great conversations already with students and medical students. So that's number one. And number two is just to say this is really the best part of my day today. When you do what I do, you finally get in, you finally get to sleep, and then when it's a horrible thing, but when a mass shooting happens, it's just like completely nonstop. And so I've been doing like nonstop interviews pretty much all day about the mass shooting. So if you hear my voice starting to go a little bit, it's because I've been doing a lot of media about this. And I'm hopeful that toward the end of our conversation, we can talk a little bit about the politics, but kind of the politics of the country. But I'm super grateful. And I guess I'll start with this question of against health. It's funny because on one hand, you know, of course, I'm a physician, right? And I trained as a physician, and people come to the physician and they want health a lot of times. And so this idea that medicine restores health, that medicine is gonna give you health back, is one of the core fundamental reasons as to why people go to the doctor. And I in no way was trying to say we're anti-health as a medical community for the most part. But it just kind of dawned on me as I started, and this was with a colleague of mine, we were doing this project, but as we started to look around at the many uses of the term health and the way that health was promoted in ways that were maybe antithetical to that medical notion of health, but also the medical community was itself a participant in that. And so we started to look around, first of all, about so many ways in which corporate claims of kind of health were tied not to like the freedom of disease, the freedom of where you were, but it was kind of like you'll be healthy if you buy this product, if you get this product. There's a long history of corporate health that it was also tied to pharmaceuticals, right? And so pharmaceuticals that weren't just about we're going to treat your illness, but like, oh, you don't have a 4-hour erection or something like that, you know, what's wrong with you or something. And so this idea that basically, you know, medications are going to restore this idea that was very, very commercialized. So that was part of it. We started looking around at health claims in food as another part of it, where one example of this was when we were writing the book, the Frito-Lay company, who makes, you know, one of my favorite foods, Fritos and Cheetos, but they were making these new quarter bags that they would sell at bodegas in inner cities. They were smaller bags of Flaming Hot Cheetos, and they would sell them by the counter of where the interactions were made. And they made all these claims that this is healthy, this is your healthy snacks. And the reason was because they had fewer Flaming Hot Cheetos in the bag than the bigger bag, was lethal. It turned out it was incredibly lucrative. These quarter bags made zillions of dollars. But this idea that basically if they would have just said, yeah, we're trying to get people hooked on Flaming Hot Cheetos, which, you know, but because they made this claim of health, it was impervious to a particular kind of critique. And so this idea that basically, if you call something healthy, you know, it's almost like, oh, it's health. You can't do that. And the other thing was just about how much of medicine, you know, and this is not wrong or anything, but it's just like tied to these particular ideas that betterment is tied to all these cultural aesthetics and socioeconomics and gender and race and class. And so we started to look at all the work that this term health was doing that was, and I don't make any claim that medicine has like cornered the market on the term health, but certainly it was this idea that medicine was not engaged in this critical conversation about all mm-hmm. the claims that people were making about health, and we just thought it was important for society and for medicine to think about that. And the other part is just, you know, when you start paying attention to it, it is a little bit sometimes, not always, but every once in a while, it's kind of nauseating, some of these health mm-hmm. claims. You know, if you just start watching enough commercials where people are invoking health or, you know, drug ads and stuff like that. I teach this class now, The Politics of Masculinity and Men's Health. And I have, you know, I'll ask my students, like, what is men's health? And they'll be quiet for a minute and then they'll be like, prostate? Like, you know, like, that's or whatever. And I'll be like, okay, and what is that exactly? And then it'll be like dead silent, you know. And that's fine. College students did not have to know what the prostate is or does. That's no problem. But then I'll be like, okay, here's an example. Here's an exercise. Why don't you guys all go online or go to the campus bookstore and go to the magazine section and look at magazines like Men's Health or Men's Fitness or something like that and see what health is in terms of how it's construed in relation to masculinity. And it was all this like, health was like buns of steel and abs of steel and six-pack abs and all this kind of stuff. And so this whole idea that, you know, we just thought this was important for doctors to know, that this thing that they were mm-hmm. promoting very uncritically was tied to all of these much bigger positions that were pretty vital mm-hmm. to know about.
Yes, I wanted to ask a question that builds upon this same conversation, and maybe it's a two-part question. On the one hand, I'm interested in your training as a doctor and scholar.
Like, yeah.
How were you socialized and habituated to think differently, to think critically about health, but also to, like, I mean, your credentials, your degrees kind of speak to this, but, like, how are you socialized to move critically across disciplines? So that's one question. The second is, do you feel that healthcare is changing in relationship to the critiques that your research is offering? I'm thinking in particular of protest psychosis that we'll ask you to talk about a little bit more in the questions that follow. So it's been about 8 years, I think, since that's been published. So has healthcare registered that critique? Has it
yeah.
changed?
Well, okay, so starting with the first one, it was just like, how did I get here, kind of, because I know there are a lot of students in the crowd. You know, I had this kind of weird training where I never quite knew exactly what I wanted to do, and I always kind of was drawn by, I mean, I loved the humanities always growing up, and I was always somebody, as we were talking about in the class before this, keenly aware of kind of social justice and race because of my family and how I grew up, and, you know, I grew up with a very activist family. And so I felt like I never quite fit in exactly. I mean, I knew that I was very good at doing things I liked and really bad at doing things I didn't like. So that was kind of the first thing. But the other part was, I was incarcerated at a young age in a six-year medical program, which is that right outside of high school. All of a sudden, I was in medical school, and it was like when they get you into this six-year medical school, like you're screwed, right? Is anybody here in six-year med school? Okay, so you know. And so the issue is like, you can't really quit because you don't really have any degree, you know, whatever, anything like that. So you're in this thing. So I was in medical school at a very young age in terms of coming out of high school. And that was great because I was in medical school. It took off a lot of the pressure, a lot of the kind of worry. Financially, it was, I think, a good move. But it was kind of like, you know, I'm learning all these things and they're important in terms of like how to treat patients, but the broader context of how to treat them, I feel like I just really had to look hard for that because in six-year med school, you end up skipping over like anthro and social. So I was actually on a targeted mission to try to build that own part of my own education. And so I did all these crazy things. I went to night school when I was in med school and I got an extra BA in English when I was in med school. Then when I did my residency in psychiatry, I snuck away and I did a master's in poetry theory while I was at Stanford doing that. And then after I finished residency, I just went back to grad school and I ended up getting a PhD as part of the Robert Wood Johnson Political Scholars Program and looked at critical race theory and medicine. And so I feel like I kind of like built my own curriculum along the way. Mm-hmm. And on one hand, I would definitely say, don't do this at home. You know, it was definitely a lot of extra work and time and things like that, but it did did really make me think about the limitations. But I guess the flip side is, even if I would have gone through a traditional medical training, I think this idea of the limitations of medical practice, of medical education, you know, there's beautiful, great, amazing things about medical education, but we were talking about before, as one example, you know, there's all this literature about how, you know, being somebody who's suffered from racism has a chance to, for example, raise your cortisol level. We know that people who have been the, you know, subject of racism, they might have a higher cortisol level, which might raise their, raise some, you know, stress hormones in their body, which then might lead them to have hypertension. And so then when you go to the doctor, it's kind of like, I've got this cortisol level that's higher. And the question is the doctor's choice at that moment is to give them an antihypertensive. No, it's also to be involved in trying to fix racism, to try to address racism. So there are all these social issues, these social causes that I felt like medicine, in its focus intensely on the individual, was decontextualizing, and I always wanted to gain that. You know, I see this crowd, and I see the work that people are doing now in med school, and doing, and I feel unbelievably encouraged. So I don't ever want to say. I mean, there was one moment where I felt like my work maybe made a difference, maybe two. One was that I got a call from the DSM committee, mm-hmm. and they were trying to revamp the criteria for schizophrenia. And I'd written this book that was really critical of certain aspects of schizophrenia. They ended up taking them out of the diagnostic right. codes. And so partially, I actually had this totally unexpected engagement with the psychosis and schizophrenia committee of the DSM. And that was one time where I thought, oh, here's a material real world implication. The second, I don't know, after today, you know, but the work on guns and mental illness hopefully has furthered our understanding of how those two things don't automatically go together. And so if there is a gun debate, I'm hopefully trying to contribute to that. But for the most part, I see this all as a continuum, right? That there's a continuum of this tension between health and social justice, the need for medicine to be aware of race and gender and social class and all kinds of different disparities and privileges that are built into how we define health. And I see it just great to see how so many students involved in that project. And so, you know, I just feel really encouraged that the work that people like me and Helena and other people have done, you know, has created this foundation for other people. And we built on work that people had done before.
How did you come to write The Protest Psychosis, which you just mentioned in passing?
Yeah, so it's funny. There were a couple ways to, about The Protest Psychosis. For people who don't know, it was a book about black men who were protesting against the government in the 60s and were locked into mental hospitals. And so the way I came to that project was that I'd written a book before called Prozac on the Couch. It was a book about depression and gender. And I went through every advertisement, every memoir, every single piece of kind of depression-based literature from like the 1920s or 30s to about the 1980s. And I would just say, if you just landed from Mars and you just looked through those materials, you would think that 100% of the people who had depression were white and about 80% of them were women. Because every single thing I looked at, every drug ad in a medical journal, every memoir written by like a woman who's like, you know, whatever, it was entirely coded as this illness of whiteness. Now, that wasn't true in terms of what was happening in the world, but it was true in terms of representation. And so the whole time I was writing the book, I kept thinking, is it true that all mental illness is coded as whiteness, or is there another dialogue? And at certain points along the way, these little pieces of information would kind of come through. One was that I found this article, a really racist article from the 30s that talked about what was called slum psychosis at the time. The idea that psychosis is an illness that spreads among, you know, the underclass in the slums and stuff like that. And it was almost like a virus and stuff like that. And after that, like black men getting overdiagnosed with schizophrenia. So there was this whole other dialogue that was about schizophrenia that wasn't at all encapsulated by the depression rhetoric. And I kept wondering, you know, how was it that these things became so split? And it turned out that they were two very different histories. And so I started tracking the history of schizophrenia. And that led me to an archive, a particular archive, where I started to tell the stories of these particular men. And it turned out that while depression had its own history that was based in one cultural moment, you know, men's fear of women entering the workforce and the, you know, post-World War II period, and this idea of needing to kind of drug women to, you know, mother's little helpers and all this kind of stuff. But schizophrenia was so tied to the politics of civil rights and black power, and this idea of kind of what we call psychosis being so tied to black political protest, that in a way the story kind of wrote itself the minute I found the archive, because I was literally finding these charts. I mean, it was these incredible moments where I would find these charts of these black men who were, you know, the diagnosis was had joined the Nation of Islam or something like that was actually the diagnosis in the chart. And those people, the doctors had diagnosed these guys as antisocial. And what happened was in 1968, they changed the diagnostic criteria for schizophrenia. And all of a sudden in 1968, the criteria for schizophrenia added the words hostile and aggressive, hostility and aggression. And all of a sudden, overnight, they would just go through the medical charts and cross out the old diagnosis and put in, per new DSM, schizophrenia. So it was this total relationship between protest, race, oppression, resistance, and psychiatric diagnosis. Psychiatric diagnosis was reflecting this moment. And so for me, this process really complicated this idea. I mean, when I started that project, if you would have told me, well, there were these black men who... they were locked into mental hospitals for protesting, I would have said, that the doctors were racist. That would probably be my first. They weren't culturally competent or something like that. But it turned out over the process of writing the book, I realized that even the most like sympathetic doctor in the world, and there were a lot of physicians of color also in these state hospitals, so they weren't just white doctors, but because they were using the tools of the profession, the DSM, which itself had become racialized and in some ways racist, because they were in this bigger system that was starting to incarcerate black political protest, and not just incarcerate it, but actually call it insane, that there was this much bigger story that in a way it wasn't just about the doctor's brain. It wasn't about the doctor's mind. It was also about this bigger structure. And so for me, that led to, the other big point of the book, which is if you think about cultural competency, which is this idea that doctors should be, you know, aware of the cultural backgrounds of their patients, of course that's important. But I kept thinking, how would cultural competency have helped these doctors at this state hospital when these guys who were political protesters showed up at their door? And it turned out it wouldn't at all, because they weren't aware at that moment of the bigger structural factors. And so that led to this recognition of how doctors really need to understand structural oppression in addition to kind of individual levels of racism.
So for those of you who haven't read the Protest Psychosis, the book is absolutely devastating. It documents lives and communities that have been undone and unraveled by the violence of institutionalization, by social protest, by communities of color having been criminalized. Jonathan, I was hoping you could tell us more about the process of working with these case files that you also recovered and preserved in many respects, the struggle and complexity of bearing witness to their suffering. It seems to me, coming from the humanities, that you're trying to also create an emotional connection, a solidarity to these individuals, to their legacy, and there's a certain ethic of compassion and responsibility. So I was hoping you could speak to that, but also, and in my two-part way, there's a second part to this question, you know, what's the legacy of this history on these families and these communities, and how is the use of the DSM for social control still happening today?
And can you just summarize in a nutshell the first part of the question?
First question is, can you talk about the ethic of, let's say, solidarity and compassion that underlied that project?
The charts, yeah.
Which was to, you know... in the most humane and humanistic way to kind of to share this story, yeah. but this incredibly devastating story.
Cool. I'm going to say one thing first just to the audience, and then I'm going to answer these two questions. Yeah. One is, just because I do a lot of media, I'm a Twitter maniac. And so if anybody has any questions along the way, I've got my phone right here, and if you want to just tweet at Jonathan Metzl, I'll try to answer questions from the audience along the way, in addition to the raising the hands kind of question. So just so we can bring people into this conversation a little bit. But I would say that... you know, it's funny, this notion of charts. I mean, one, and I guess we all face this as researchers or clinicians or things like that. Like, we don't have ownership over other people's stories on one hand. And on the other hand, when you're writing a book about people's stories, you are kind of co-opting their stories, right? And the story has gone through multiple levels. It's gone through, it's been said to the doctor who then dictated it, it was sent to the transcription person who typed it in those days and stuff like that. So it feels like a real responsibility you're holding in your life to kind of recuperate this voice. And I feel like on one hand, my use of kind of just verbatim stuff from my research, I'm doing it in my current book also, is in part to say, I have heard this material. People have spoken it to me, or I've read it. It's coming from people's real lives. But I don't want just my interpretation of this to be the only interpretation. In other words, I feel like there are multiple ways to read any kind of text, and these kind of narratives are the same. And so number one is just to say that, I mean, and it was also true, as we'll talk about in a little bit here in the book that I've just finished now that's coming out, I will also say that, you know, even... I've been interviewing people who I strongly disagree with, and I've tried to use a similar kind of thing as if to say, you know, there's an analytic lens, of course, that I'm employing, but I also want this to be a process of interpretation, and also to be respectful. I mean, I feel funny. I even feel funny about this now, and I do it, right? I get research data, I get group data, I get interview data, and then I turn it into a chart about themes and all this kind of stuff, and part of me kind of feels like bummed out about that, right? Because it's very much like, you think you know about your life, but I'm going to cull the data and let me tell you about your life. It's part of this bigger trend and stuff like that. But of course, on the flip side, that's what we do as researchers. And so part of it is just to suggest, at least to try to suggest, a particular kind of humility that I feel lucky that people are telling me their stories in the first place. And then I guess the other part in this particular instance was that these charts were lost to history. They were totally lost to history. This was a hospital called Ionia State Hospital, and the charts were slated for destruction before I got a court thing to stop them. And so these voices were not going to be heard, right? And it was kind of like worse than I thought it was going to be. Like, remember the end of the first Raiders of the Lost Ark, where it's like they take the ark and they just stick it back in the room? But it was worse because they were just heaped in these boxes. And so, in a way, people who went to these state hospitals were themselves so archived, you know, and put away. But then, you know, so I felt like a real duty. And then the last part is just the stories were so tragic. Like, it was kind of like, I mean, for me, the most powerful point, if anybody knows the book, the most tragic point of the book were these letters that the person and the family kept writing, trying to say, get my family member out of the hospital. And it was just, they were unanswered letters. So I in that case, I felt a real duty. I felt a real duty. Unfortunately, in terms of the second part of your question, there was something kind of, I think, evil going on, evil systemically, right? I don't know about one person's intention, but when you called somebody mentally ill, you could incarcerate them for the rest of their life, basically. And so a lot of the story of the book also is particularly black men who had done, you know, shoplifting or something like that, and they were in for a 1 to 3 year sentence. They had something bad happen in prison. They got put into solitary. They got really paranoid when they were in solitary. By the time they got to the mental hospital, they were paranoid. And so the doctor didn't know any of this history. They looked paranoid. And then the minute you diagnose them with this serious mental illness, a 1 to 3 year sentence becomes a life sentence in many ways. And then on top of that, a lot of the men, the facility itself became a prison. The mental hospital actually became a prison. And so the minute it became a prison, all these people were recast as prisoners. And then it was like danger to others, whatever. So it was this story about It was a story about a lot of things, but it was kind of a really structural story about the ways that we create institutions around what we deem social problems that make just that make escape really hard. Now, I know this sounds like, oh my God, what a bummer on a day where like RBG fell and broke some ribs and stuff like that. But I will say that it, for me, I found something very empowering about figuring out the mechanism through which it happened. In other words, we hear like, oh, the prison industrial complex, and that's where we house the mentally ill people and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But just seeing, well, yes, that's definitely how it is, but it also is the result of a bunch of decisions. Mm-hmm. So when I could just trace the decisions that were all, then I just thought like, okay, at least I know that decisions led to this point so that then we can mm-hmm. unmake decisions or make different decisions. So, you know, that for me, that was kind of a legacy. But in terms of individual stories, people here might have heard of this thing called deinstitutionalization, the idea that like we opened the doors and everybody went free and, you know, everybody flew out of the mental hospital. But it turned out, at least in my hospital, if you were African-American man, you were not being deinstitutionalized. It was largely the kind of white women with depression who were getting set mm-hmm. free and other kind of people. But the black men were all getting recast as prisoners. So.
This question perhaps is one that you've already answered, but before we turn to the election aftermath and dying of whiteness, I was hoping you could speak a little bit more about the politics of listening and of caring. This is, of course, the subject of so much of your work. It's the subject of a lot of our activity here. So given this history of racism, given this history of colonizing practice, given the subjugation of people, of bodies, through discourses of health, like what does listening and care mean today?
Well, first let me just say, I might need some help from the audience on this question. I mean, of course, we need to listen to each other more. And I think there are obvious ways in which we need to listen to each other more, but one of them has nothing to do with medicine whatsoever. It's because I'm writing a book now about polarization and the political effects of polarization, right? I feel like as a society, we've lost the ability to listen to each other. And I mean, I realize we're going to go to the new book later, but I've spent like the last 4 or 5 years talking to people in the Tea Party and going to NRA meetings and doing focus groups with anti-Obamacare activists and stuff like that. And I don't know, like it was weird how many times we found some point we could agree on or something like that. And so part of the issue is just to say for the young people of this country that this whole two-party system is set up to think mm-hmm. that we all hate each other, right? Mm-hmm. That we can't listen to each other. There's no middle ground. There's no point of agreement. And there are huge stakes of that. And so partially I feel like any expertise in breaking down binaries right now, any expertise in terms of listening to each other, I feel like is a really useful tool that I feel like medicine and psychiatry and other disciplines really need to be more vocal about. And I'll give you one example from the stuff I do on guns. So you guys maybe know this, but after the mass shooting in Sandy Hook, they passed this bill. There's another bill called the SAFE Act in New York that they passed. And it put psychiatrists on the front lines of needing to predict which one of their patients that could be violent. You know, you have to go and report them to authorities and take away their guns. It made psychiatrists into this diagnosis machine where you actually had to diagnose which one of your patients was going to go shoot somebody or had a gun or something like that. And so what happened actually after this is that a billion people got put on the no-fly list, the psychiatric no-fly list, because psychiatrists, the minute they heard that, they were like, man, if somebody goes to shoot somebody, I'm going to be liable. And so all of a sudden, there was a huge over-reporting of psychiatric patients because nobody wanted to be liable. But I feel like it was such a misuse of mental health expertise, because mental health expertise is really good at asking people questions like, why do you feel you need a gun in the first place? What makes you feel safe about it, your gun? What do you enjoy about your gun? What's sublime about your gun? What are your experiences of your gun? In other words, to get at the deeper issues, to have a listening conversation, even if it's a politics we don't agree with, and to try to kind of create common conversations. And so it made me really sad that psychiatry was stuck in this one position of, I mean, obviously it was incredibly, you know, legal and juridical and all these kind of things, but But not to listen, right? And so I guess hopefully what you can hear in what I'm saying is that I think there's a relationship between listening and politics and policy and other factors. It's not just about the clinical encounter. But I think that that's very, I think that that's incredibly important to remember that listening is itself a kind of political act or can be.
Well, let's talk about dying of whiteness. Dying of Whiteness, How Racial Resentment is Killing America's Heartland. Is that right?
That is right.
Basic Books, April?
It's coming out the last week of March. In fact, one of my first book talks, the first week of March, and I'm giving one of my first book talks here at Penn, at Jefferson and at Penn, so.
Okay, you're at Jefferson on April 27th,
yeah.
I believe.
Is that right?
So, yes.
Okay, sounds good.
Please come.
But I'm in New York all the time. I'll have to come back, so yeah.
Well, tell us about it. It takes up some of these themes in the context of sort of the current administration's politics and policies.
Yeah. So, Dying of Whiteness. Again, it's hard to. I mean, I'm going to talk about a book that's not out yet, right? But basically, I work on guns and health, and I live in Tennessee. And I was doing a focus group project when Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, was just kind of announced. It was just passed, and we were doing these focus groups with white men in Tennessee, and it was like in lower income housing community housing in kind of at the outskirts of Nashville, very very poor area, and I was with my student, and we were sitting around a group of like 12 white men who had any kind of medical, I mean, really kind of severe, like liver failure, COPD, really chronic hepatitis, other things where, you know, you kind of want to be under the care of a physician because these are chronic medical conditions. And these chronic medical conditions need a level of ongoing kind of maintenance. So the Affordable Care Act came out, and there was a big push, I think, from, you know, at the time, the government to say, here's what the Affordable Care Act can do. You'll have a doctor. We're going to decrease, you know, uninsured rates, all these kind of things. So we're talking to these men, and every guy that we talked to was refusing. They were refusing to sign up for it. They refused to enter the marketplace. They refused to support the expansion. And it was this powerful thing where over the 6 months that we did these focus groups, the men actually started dying of untreated medical conditions. And I would ask them, like, hey, you know, here's a program that actually could help you get medications or a liver transplant maybe or something like that. Like, wouldn't you think that that might be helpful? And we were in Tennessee, too. We were 40 minutes away from Kentucky, and Kentucky did adopt the Affordable Care Act. Mm-hmm. So I spent like 6 months talking to these guys and saying, isn't that a good thing? And they would be like, no way. We don't want this. There's no way we want it. And I would say, why don't you want the Affordable Care Act? And their answer always was, because Mexicans and welfare queens, I don't want my tax dollars going to Mexicans and welfare queens. I don't want them taking my money. I don't want them taking my resources. I don't want them taking my privileges, right? And so these guys were literally dying of this ideology, right? I mean, here were men who could have accessed treatment under a different regime, but instead they were deciding to hold on to this idea of a hierarchy, right? This idea that they had a certain kind of privilege that put them in a pyramid above, as they said, Mexicans and welfare queens, people who were taking their resources, taking what was owed to them, taking all of these other factors. Mm. And so I really thought a lot about what was the cost of this ideology, right? Because, of course, this wasn't just happening in a room in Tennessee. This was this was the Tea Party platform and then the Trump platform. It's basically like resist, don't give in, you know, the government's out to get you and all this kind of thing. Now, sometimes, yes, the government's out to get you. But it really made me think, what's the cost of this ideology? And it became a much broader contemplation just about, I mean, for me, it's really about how this idea of a much bigger idea about whiteness as being on the top of a particular hierarchy. It's an interaction that we see in a lot of different places. How bad that is for everybody, for the nation, and also for white people, right? Because this position of being put into a position where your idea of privilege is dependent on you rejecting your healthcare, right? That's a really powerful idea. So that's point number one. Then point number two is also This was a point that many liberals overlooked in the lead up to the election, which was that there were a lot of poor conservative people who were so desperate or so fanatical or so whatever that they were willing to die for these positions. Mm-hmm. So it's also like, imagine the depth of attachment to a particular issue that you would have to refuse your own health care. Mm-hmm. And so I started looking at other examples of that. I looked at this broad spread of guns in gun culture, where there was like an epidemic of white male suicide among white communities, but it made people more pro-gun. I looked at funding cuts to education, and I talked to people about why they would support education cuts to their own kids' schools, right? And again, it kept tying back to this idea that there was a group of people who were going to get what's owed to me or something like that. And so it became, I mean, it's funny because I was doing this research for 3 years before the 2016 election, and I kept telling people, you know, I would not underestimate this, right? It's really, really deep, and it's really powerful, and it's the opposite of what you're thinking of, because you're thinking of it in terms of kind of an enlightened reason. Like, why would anybody reject their own health care? But it turned out that logic made a lot of sense in a different kind of context. And then I guess the last part of the book is just to say, we hear a lot about Trump supporters voting against their own self-interests. Now, this is a class argument, right? It's mostly lower-income white populations who are voting against their own self-interests. And I just wanted to quantify what that meant, right? Mm-hmm. So it's also a research book about how much are they really voting against their own self-interests. And I actually did a bunch of data research to look at how many days of life would it cost the average person to live in a state where you rejected Obamacare. And so I actually tracked, and for example, with the healthcare section, every white person, if you aggregate it, every white person in the state lived 17 days shorter life because of the rejection of Obamacare. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot, but, you know, 2.5 weeks of life aggregated across the entire white population of a very white state turns out to be like a pretty big number when you add it up. And so it was kind of like, what's the price? What's the price people are paying for these polarizing positions? Mm-hmm.
You had your question about
I was going to ask, how are the Twitter questions coming?
Let's see.
I feel like maybe we should take some questions from the audience.
Yeah, just to orient everybody. So we have a kind of a series of questions that we want to ask, and we're also going to break out and kind of stop speaking and pass around a mic as well. So.
You want me to ask one more?
Yeah, you have one, I have one or two, and then we're done.
Well, is it okay if I skip the one that's... I'm just doing whatever I want.
Yeah, do whatever you want.
So I wanted to ask
I'm going
to
answer the other one, even if you ask me to answer.
I want to get back to that, the gun question.
Yeah, the gun question.
Okay,
yeah,
that's the one I was going to skip for
you're
now.
You're skip? No. Okay, maybe can I jump in?
Ask
okay.
Jump in.
Okay, so, I mean, I know you've seen these questions before, but so, you know, in the reading group, we've been reading Foucault, we've been reading Deleuze, we've been reading about biopolitics and governmentality.
Is that the one you're going to skip? Okay, yeah.
So how does that discussion map on to the current laws concerning the right to bear arms? I'm thinking in particular of stand your ground laws in Florida and elsewhere. To me, kind of thinking theoretically, it seems like we've moved away from a culture where you have a right to bear arms in presumed self-defense to one where you have a right to kill now, or at least certain people have a right to kill, and they've in a way taken that right on from the state, kind of continuing a long history in this country of the normalization of violence by white people. So, can you talk about, you know, what are the implications of stand your ground laws? You know, how does this fit into your larger work?
So guns, I mean, I'll just say first how I got to guns. I mean, I actually do have something to say about governmentality. But let me start by saying one thing about how I got to guns. So it's funny because I got to guns because of the protest psychosis, because of the schizophrenia book. And I didn't expect it, but there was a section there just about how different society treats different forms of embodied violence, right? Mm-hmm. And so part of it was kind of like a couple pages where I said, and a perfect example of this is firearms, where guns, for people who know the history, have been held up as a white prerogative in this country for about 200 years, using rhetoric like the Second Amendment and the NRA and the right to bear arms, and it all went into like, you know, stand your ground and stuff like that. But there are also these examples of when black political leaders tried to co-opt those same arguments and say, well, actually, the Second Amendment applies to us too. Malcolm X would be a great example, holding up the gun and the rifle in a very famous image. But if people want to go and look at YouTube, just Google Malcolm X Second Amendment. It's amazing because he's making this argument. The Second Amendment enshrines our ability to stand up to a tyrannical government. Now, there's another guy, Robert Williams. Anybody here read the book Negroes with Guns from the 1950s? Incredible book about what it meant to be black and try to defend yourself in South Carolina and North Carolina in the 50s and 60s. It turned out he kind of needed a gun because the cops weren't coming. The people who were coming were policemen with hoods and torches and stuff like that. So his argument was nobody's protecting us. The Second Amendment has to be what protects us. And when black political leaders started making these arguments, all of a sudden, the whole apparatus of the state turned on them, right? And in mental illness played a very important part here. When Malcolm X held up that rifle, an FBI profiler diagnosed him with pre-psychotic paranoid schizophrenia. Became one of the ways they were trying to incarcerate him was because of mental illness. When Robert Williams, who wrote Negroes with Guns, when he wrote this book, there are FBI 10 Most Wanted posters all across the South all of a sudden, and it said armed, dangerous, and schizophrenic. And so this idea that when black men were trying to use this language, all of a sudden, it became this language that was turned on, right? It became this language of insanity. And so I just couldn't shake that. And I'd forgotten about that part of the book, to be honest, until the Trayvon Martin shooting. Mm-hmm. And then one of my best friends, who actually I was in the back texting with her before this started, she says hi, but Melissa Harris Perry is one of my dear friends forever. She had this show, and when Trayvon went on, she asked me to come on and talk about the Trayvon and Stand Your Ground laws and how this tied in. And what people were forgetting at that time was there was this long history of the white defender and the black threat, right? How society responded differently. And so all of a sudden, after going on about Trayvon, then I went on about mass shootings. I went on about guns. So it kind of came out of this moment. And it's interesting, I guess the one point that I guess would be an interesting point to think about is that if you look at the Malcolm X argument, the Robert Williams argument, we have a right to protect ourselves. Second Amendment applies to all Americans. We protect ourselves from a tyrannical government. That turns out that's the platform of the Tea Party and the NRA right now. And so in a way, there's been this co-optation, right, of these arguments used in a very, very different sense, but still with their racially charged undertones. And one last thing I'll say about that is part of the point is, like, for example, if you think about open carry, I mean, Stand Your Ground, don't even get me started, because there's great research now just about who can claim Stand Your Ground. But even open carry, if you just look at who gets to open carry, it's these white armed defenders who are called patriots who are going through Walmart and burrito restaurants and stuff like that. But the flip side is when black men open carry, they're tackled and, all this kind of stuff. So there's still this racial politics, I think, that plays out to the ways that gun laws are playing out. But I have one last thing to say about guns. The NRA... with respect to anybody who's an NRA member, we can talk about this. I mean, I'm not actually anti-gun after writing this book. But I will say that the NRA is now starting to try to advertise to black communities, and basically saying the cops aren't going to protect you, you need a gun. It's just an untapped market for them. So that I can say more about that. But, this could all change at any moment. But,
Well, I wanted to ask about
I'm sorry, one last thing. just one quick Foucault point, which is if you think about governmentality and this idea that basically we're being surveilled all the time, and it's not just the way we used to be surveilled, but now we're surveilled in all these new ways, it's really hard to map that onto present-day politics, because I feel like that's a very right-wing argument also, like all these anti-government positions are what spread to the expansion. So governmentality has led in many ways to the expansion of surveillance in a certain kind of way. So it's just funny to look at these rightist anti-government rhetorics that are being used to put people like Trump in power and to squash to squash dissent and things like that. So it's hard to know the politics of Foucault right now. I mean, I'm in and all that kind of thing. But it's hard because a lot of these things, we were talking before, all these like traditionally leftist critiques of power structures. Another one from like way back before anybody here was born was this thing called postmodernism. And it was this idea that like there's no true fact and everything is up for debate and you know there's no master narrative, and like who's the ultimate postmodernist right now about there's no true facts and stuff like that. So it's kind of like these ideas of critiques of power are it's really an interesting moment, right? Because they're so easily twisted into proto-fascist arguments in a kind of way. So
yeah. Can you talk a bit about being a public intellectual, sort of being in public space with some of the arguments that you make, including the refusal of the argument that mental illness is what we should be concerned about rather than restricting access to guns when it comes to mass shootings?
Yeah, it's funny because I love this question, and also I did 14 interviews today before coming here. And then I'm taking the night train back to New York, so I'm doing NPR in the morning. And NPR also, again, is saying, can you talk about the links between mental illness and mass shootings?
Wow.
That's, again, and all day, all you know, the thing is, you know, there's this thing. And so, in a way, I feel like the reason I push back on that point, one of it doesn't really have to do with the mental illness issue at all. It's that I feel like the NRA has trained everybody to immediately think the mental illness narrative. It's mm-hmm. so effective. They don't even have to promote it so much anymore. We just jump to it in a way. So they've been promoting that for years and years. Whenever there was a mass shooting, they would say, we need a mental illness database, or they used to have this slogan, guns don't kill people, the mentally ill do. And so partially it's kind of like, no, like we fall into that trap. And so I don't know, I feel like there is slight part of me, just the part of me that hasn't gotten enough sleep, that is like, gosh, every mass shooting we say the same thing. But at the same time, mental illness is so much a part of these these stories, like the horrible shooting today or last night, that it's also like you don't want to avoid mental illness. And so I think it's an opportunity to talk about it. And so I'll say that my position about this, on one hand, is certainly that there are high-risk people who should not have access to weapons. And a lot of times it's not psychiatrists who know that, it's mm-hmm. family members, right? Mm-hmm. So if you want a strategy for how to get guns and weapons away from high-risk people, psychiatrists kind of suck at predicting. And the part of the reason is that there's no diagnosis that's like mass shooter disorder. But the other part is they rarely have a point of reference. Like they see somebody today, but they don't know if they've been escalating or not. So there is one piece of legislation called a gun violence restraining order, GVRO, mm-hmm. that it's one of the things we should all be supporting, because it's like today, this guy, for people who follow the story, he lived with his mom. Did his mom see him escalating? Mm-hmm. Did his mom see him getting guns or something like that? So part of the idea of a GVRO is to say this isn't just a mental health issue. It's actually like communities can band together because they know who's escalating. I guarantee you for that Pittsburgh maniac from before in the synagogue shooting, there were people in that guy's life. Mm-hmm. That guy's not going to go to see a psychiatrist and be like, Doc, man, I'm sorry, I'm so down in the dumps, you know, whatever. He never was going to go to see a psychiatrist. And so I think part of the issue is, can we give tools that are giving up some of the psychiatric authority to communities? So I think one of the points I make is that if there are high-risk people, mental health expertise is important. Number two is that we shouldn't just focus on mental illness and mass shootings. There is a much bigger problem in the United States, unfortunately, and it's called everyday gun violence. So even though we all pay attention around the times of mass shootings, as horrible as mass shootings are, probably 400 people die a year. You know, every death is a death too many. But everyday violence has killed now more than 40,000 people a year. It's going up rapidly. And so I feel like part of the argument is if we just focus on mental illness, there's nothing we can do about it. But it turns out everyday gun violence is very patterned. It's very predictable. There are many things we can do about it. And so I feel like it's used as this argument to say, oh, we could have predicted it. Well, we can stop everyday gun violence. And so in that regard, if you look at everyday gun violence, There is no correlation between mental illness and everyday gun violence. There's actually not a correlation between mental illness diagnosis and even gun suicide, right? It's often a very impulsive act. And so this idea that we're stigmatizing people is to me very much a red herring, that people with mental illness are not the target group, right? They're not the most volatile or violent group. And so the idea that the reason I'm saying this is the only people who have any authority to like do anything about this are mental health practitioners, right? Isn't that weird, right? Because after all these laws, like, you know, the SAFE Act and stuff like that, it's only the mental health practitioners who have the right to, like, you know, say, hey, this person is escalating or something like that. But the people who see mental health practitioners are mental health patients, and they're not the most dangerous group. They're not the group. I mean, there are risk factors for gun violence, but mental illness diagnosis is not in the top 10. And so, you know, we really could focus on substance use, past history of violence, past history of partner violence, access to firearms, certain social networks, lack of handgun training. There are all these things that have nothing to do with mental illness diagnosis that we could be focusing on. So I feel like it's a very useful red herring. And then we take it up. I mean, believe it or not, I guarantee you, anybody listen to NPR tomorrow, it's actually liberal NPR that pushes back on me the most when I say this stuff, because they're like, they want it to be mental illness. And I understand that, you know what I mean? It's like, here's us, the civilized, and we want it to be the crazy person over there. So I understand that, but it's so powerful, that narrative.
Hmm. Okay, so one last question before we turn it over to everybody here. And it returns to Megan's first question about the painfulness for health professionals of having any conversation like this one. There's all sorts of amazing euphemisms. Social determinants of health is probably the most familiar one. And that they speak to the complexity, these euphemisms speak to the complexity of engaging these kinds of conversations in transformative ways. So can you talk about the disincentives to talking about these issues in research and clinical care, and given that there are many students in the room, how we can make it safe for students to advance and participate in these conversations?
And can you just nut graph that for one second? Yeah, give me the take-home point. Give me the take-home point.
First question, can you talk about the disincentives, the euphemisms that make it impossible to actually have a transformative conversation? And what students can do to push back.
And I guess that was where I was asking is, what do you mean transformative conversation? Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, we're having a transformative conversation. Mm-hmm. I'm feeling transformed, but do you mean like change the culture of medicine?
Within the spaces of clinical care and research. Like, how can we do things differently? How can students push back? How can they radicalize the conversations?
Yeah, so what can students do, right? And it's funny because can all the really cool Jefferson students I talked to before, raise your hands, everybody. So we just had a great conversation about this, right? It was really cool because it was kind of like, yeah, you teach me all this socially constructed stuff or politics or frame or structure, and then you're in the clinical encounter, and it's not like a patient goes into the doctor and says, you know, I'm suffering from this problem, and you don't want the doctor to say, well, sir, you're suffering from a socially constructed problem and we have to change society. No, people go to the doctor to get treated for individual problems, and I understand that. That's always going to be a profound imperative of medical training. But I also think that this sole focus on just what happens in the clinical encounter and not seeing the broader context is one of the reasons there's just, I think, a lot of frustration. I'll give you one example. There was a Robert Wood Johnson study 2 years ago, pediatricians and primary care doctors, and they asked them two questions. One is, do you think that unmet social needs are leading to worse health for Americans? And 85% of doctors said, yes, we think that's true. And then they asked, do you feel confident in your ability to address unmet social needs in your patients? And 90% said, I have no freaking idea what to do. I have no idea, right? And so it's interesting, but this is a historical moment, right? We live in a moment where people have particular forms of healthcare. Healthcare happens in a particular place. It happens whether or not you're paying for it in a particular way, what medication you get. But it always hasn't always been the case, right? In the 60s, for example, there was the community health movement, where, you know, it turned out to be problematic in some ways, but doctors were out there in the community creating these nodes, engaging with communities. The Black Panthers were out in the community creating these health clinics. And so this idea of medicine being this one thing that happens in this one place is something that it hasn't always been the case, right? And so partially, I think students can learn that there are other formations of the notion of care that can happen that create that. Number two, for people who have heard of our term structural competency, it's very slightly a joke. I don't mean it as a joke like, haha. What I mean is you're not going to ever be structurally competent. So we were slightly poking fun at medicine's need to, like, you know, now they have like religious competency and gender competency. And like, if you look, talk to a gender scholar or a religion scholar, they would never ever say that competency was what they were aiming. Like, the whole goal of religion is that you're always humble, right? And so this idea of being competent is something that we were trying to say, it's a quest. And part of what you need in that quest is to recognize that every problem isn't a clinical problem, and medical expertise is not the answer to every problem. And so when you're seeing these social trends, you might want to create alliances with city planners. You might want to push the American Medical Association to support the Affordable Care Act more than just based on reimbursements. You might want to think about ways that you can partner with, you know, social workers and community activists and things like that to actually address some of these issues. And so it's a call to recognize the limitations of medical expertise that I think is partially to say you're not competent by yourself, but there need to be new communities. Mm-hmm.